Good morning. We're delighted to welcome Southwest Wisconsin Technical College. Let the students please stand. Thank you. You may be seated. Have you all received material about this case? Some yes, some no. Anyone who would like a synopsis of this case, whether you're a student or not, please raise your hand and the marshal will deliver a summary to you. If we don't have enough, we'll duplicate some more. Delighted to welcome you, and as you may or may not know, the court has a program sponsored with the State Bar of Wisconsin, a award-winning program that invites students to attend sessions of the court, and we provide materials for the students. They may have done some extra activities about the case in their class. And part of the program is that at noon, a justice of this court meets with the students to talk about the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. So let me now introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I am Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is an empty chair, as you all observed, and usually seated therein is Justice John Wilcox, who is not participating in this case. And Justice Wilcox is the justice with whom you're going to meet at noon, so he will magically appear at that time. Seated to the right of the empty chair is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right, Justice Patience Robinsack. With those introductions made, we will introduce our first case, 03-AP-1806, Metropolitan Ventures, LLC versus GEA Associates. Arguing on behalf of GEA Associates is Charles Barr. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chief Justice. May it please the Court. I'm Charles Barr. I represent GEA Associates, Elizabeth Levins, and Margaret Royce as trustee of the Henry S. Royce Trust. They were the sellers and Metropolitan Ventures the buyer under the contract at issue. This Court granted our petition to consider the scope and the continued vitality of a line of unanimous decisions starting with this Court's 1962 decision in Geruth. That will in turn determine whether there was ever an enforceable contract between these parties. The focus here is on the conditions to the buyer's obligation to purchase found in the contract's financing and appraisal contingency. This contingency raises two distinct but related questions. First, whether the contingency was so indefinite as to prevent a court from ascertaining whether it had been satisfied, that is, from ascertaining the terms of the party's agreement. Second, whether the buyer's unfettered discretion to determine whether the contingency was met, whether rendered its contractual promise illusory, that is, no promise at all. Under Geruth and its progeny, the answer to both questions is yes. The Court of Appeals, out of whole cloth, fashioned an exception to these cases for so-called business sales and attempted to distinguish these from real estate sales. This exception is devoid of authority, unworkable in practice, and implicitly overrules Geruth and its progeny. This Court should reject the Court of Appeals' claimed exception to the Geruth line of cases, reaffirm the vitality of those cases, and hold that they control this case. Geruth and its progeny implement an important judicial policy. It requires the parties to come up with a contract that is both sufficiently definite and that makes a real promise by specifying the terms of financing and an appraisal under which the deal can close. This policy has several beneficial effects.
Let me just interrupt you for one moment. As I read these briefs, the only issue that you're presenting is the issue of the enforceability of this contract with that financial clause. Now, the brief for the GEA Associates raises another issue, which is whether there was a breach of Levins and Royce in the contract sale. Levins breached, whether she breached her fiduciary duties. Is that an issue in this case? Was that in the petition for review?
It was not an issue on which we petitioned for review, and for that reason, and it's not an issue on which this Court granted review, for that reason, we don't believe those issues are properly before the Court.
So weren't those issues argued in the lower courts, though?
They were argued in the trial court. That was the basis of our first motion for summary judgment. And the trial court, in fact, dismissed most of the buyer's claims even before it addressed the issue of the enforceability of the contract. Then on a second motion for summary judgment, the trial court dismissed the entire case on the grounds that the contract was not valid because of the illusory and indefinite financing and appraisal contingency.
My understanding from your opponent's brief is that the issues are raised in regard to Levine's conduct and the conduct of the limited partners who rescinded their initial assignments. That was argued at the trial court and also at the Court of Appeals, but the Court of Appeals chose a different method to reverse the trial court and so didn't address those issues. Am I incorrect about that?
You're correct, Justice Rogenczak. The Court of Appeals had both sets of issues before it, if you will. It chose not to address the issues of whether there had been a breach, assuming the contract was valid. And even on motion for reconsideration submitted by Metropolitan, it declined specifically to address those issues. So we don't believe those issues are properly before the Court. Of course, I'm prepared to discuss them if the Court wishes. But the issues on which the Court granted review have to do with the validity of the contract in light of the financing and appraisal contingency.
Thank you. Court did not strike those pages in the brief, but it didn't give you extra pages to answer them either, if I remember that. Okay. Just trying to get this in a posture. I understand. Thank you.
Counsel, as you embark again on the argument, just for clarification, is it your client that drafted this contract?
Well, the contract was there were participation of both sides in the drafting of the contract. There is a dispute as to the extent to which the parties participated in drafting of the financing and appraisal contingency. As a matter of just logic, it would be senseless for a seller's attorney to draft a financing and appraisal contingency that is indefinite or that reposes total discretion in the buyer as to whether the contingency is fulfilled. That typically emanates from the buyer who wants to preserve freedom of action and wants a guaranteed escape hatch if the buyer can get it. And that's what found its way into this
contract. Does it make any difference? I mean, I have in the back of my mind the maxim of, you know, construing things against the drafter, that sort of area of the law. Let's say you did draft this contract and this particular financing provision. Does that in any way change your position or the analysis the court should bring to this case?
No, Justice Bradley, because the contingency is not ambiguous. That's not its problem. The contingency is indefinite and it's illusory, or it's at least one of the two.
I know. That seems like an awfully fine hair. You say it's we drafted, I'm assuming, no, I'm not saying you did, I'm just assuming in my hypothetical. We drafted a financing clause that is clear and unambiguous. Now, it's also, not lawful, in that it's not enforceable, but it is clear and unambiguous. That's the hair I hear you splitting, and it sounds a little unusual. Can you respond to that?
Well, in the last analysis, ultimately, it doesn't matter who drafted it. The contingency is there for the buyer's benefit. It was part of the instrument that the party signed, and the buyers continually asserted in this case repeatedly that the contingency is there for its benefit. So concomitantly, the buyer is responsible for the legal consequences of its wording. As I say, it would be very strange indeed, and the record does not support the inference that the seller drafted this particular provision. But in the last analysis, I don't think it makes any difference.
I read a part of your opposing counsel's brief that suggested to me that from their position it's GEA that did the drafting. But I don't know that to be true. I'm just saying that's the way I read their brief, is asserting that.
There was some colloquy on this in the trial court on the second summary judgment motion, and I believe it's part of the appendix. And at that point, the buyer admitted at that oral argument that the seller's counsel did not draft the contingency at issue, but does claim that there was some back and forth drafting of the contract generally, including that contingency. But again, I think in the last analysis, I would submit in the last analysis, the contingency is there for the buyer's benefit. It would be surpassingly strange if the seller had drafted it, if the seller had imposed it on the buyer. But even if that were surpassingly strange consequence were true, ultimately it's for the buyer's benefit and the buyer is responsible for its wording. The Geruth line of cases implements an important judicial policy, and that is...
I'm sorry. Let me back up and follow up on Justice Bradley's questions. If it was for... Your argument is that it's for the buyer's benefit.
Yes.
But if it's drafted by the seller and it's drafted in a way that, as you argue, is illusory and indefinite, that also then gives the seller an escape hatch. Why wouldn't it be in the seller's interest to do it in that fashion?
It wouldn't, Justice Butler, because it would not give the seller a guaranteed escape hatch. That's why it would
not guaranteed, but...
It wouldn't give it an escape hatch that was totally in its control. The contingency here said that... the financing contingency terminated the contract unless the buyer obtained financing on terms satisfactory to the buyer. So that doesn't help the seller at all. That's obviously for the buyer's benefit.
But if you drafted a contract that, as you argue, is illusory and indefinite, and then decide you don't want to go through with the contract, you can say this is an illusory and indefinite contract.
Well, then why would this seller go through that exercise? It's kind of a tortured...
I understand, but it's just... And I think the question of Justice Bradley is, you have to look at who's drafting, or do we have to look at who's drafting? But if you do, we don't always know the motives of the drafter, and that's why I think the general maxim is there.
Well, I think first you look to the language of the contingency and see if what it's saying is unclear or not, and that's not the problem here. It's pretty clear that it's indefinite or illusory, and if it's clear on its face what it's trying to say, then I don't think you have to look at who drafted it. As I say, it would be a very, very strange circumstance if the seller were to do this. Why would the seller go through that exercise when nobody's going to be bound? Why wouldn't the seller just move on to another buyer? Typically, and in the natural course of things, the buyer is going to propose a contingency such as this or financing and appraisal contingencies in general.
Counselor, I want to talk to you a little bit about the fiduciary duty issue. And I want you to tell me whether you think Ms. Levine had a fiduciary duty to convey Steadfast May 8th 2002 offer to the limited partnership. And tell me why you believe your answer is correct, whichever way you go.
If I understand your question correctly, Justice Rosenstock, you're asking whether Elizabeth Levins had a fiduciary duty to her limited partners to convey the information. And the answer is yes.
Why?
Because a general partner, both by statute and by common law in Wisconsin, and I believe the chapter number is 179 of the statutes, has a fiduciary duty to her limited partners. What is that duty? It's the duty to give them relevant and complete information so that they can make a decision based on full information and knowledgeable about the facts. It's not a duty to recommend one or the other, to tell them what to do. So I don't think there's any question that she had a limited duty to her partners, to convey this information. It would have been highly unreasonable for her to conceal this information from her limited partners. And as you can imagine, her limited partners would have been very upset to find out later that there was interest expressed by another party while this contract was pending. Related to this, of course, is the trial court's finding, untouched by the Court of Appeals, that there was no exclusivity provision in this contract. In other words, GEA was perfectly entitled to consider a secondary offer, to enter into a secondary contract pending the Metropolitan deal, and the wisdom of doing so is illustrated by this very case where Metropolitan pulled out of the first contract between the parties for purchase of the real estate because it didn't like the price.
Counsel, in your brief and in the letter she wrote to the limited partners, she said this was an unsolicited offer. Is that an agreed-upon fact between the two sides to this dispute, or is that a question that would have to be decided by a finder of fact?
It depends on what you mean by unsolicited.
You didn't go looking for it.
It's undisputed that Ms. Levitt and GEA did not go looking for it. Now, they had a broker, and the broker had the property on the market, Steadfast came to the broker and said, "We are interested." So if that's soliciting, it certainly wasn't actively solicited. That's what the record shows.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Counsel. Mr. Barr, if I might, let me ask you sort of back where you started from. I understood you indicated that the Court of Appeals had moved away from Giroux, that they sort of came up with the approach they took here out of whole cloth. And I'm having some trouble accepting that, and I'll tell you why. I'm having trouble because of the computer management computer services case and also the Herder case. In management computer services, basically we said, and that was a business situation, we said that if you can discern from the conduct of the parties what was intended, that you should then enforce that intention, and that you could indeed have some vague terms in a contract. But if the conduct leads you to what they really intended, you ought to enforce that intent. And my understanding is Herder does something very similar to that. How do you get around those cases? And why do you think that the Court of Appeals came up with their approach out of whole cloth, given those cases?
The Herder case, well, first of all, you can ascertain what the parties intended here, Justice Crooks, and that is that the buyer have sole and unfettered discretion to determine the terms of the financing. The problem is that a promise at all, or is it illusory? Now, the Herder case found that, the Court of Appeals did rely on Herder, but we believe and we submit that that reliance was misplaced. In Herder, the missing term was the price. And the Court of Appeals in that case cited Corbin for the rule that in a commercial case, it can be presumed that the parties, as actors in the market, intend a market or some other reasonable price. And the contract in that case was enforced by the Court of Appeals expressly because Red Mirror, the buyer in that case, failed to overcome that presumption. But a market or a reasonable price is objectively determinable. The terms of financing and an appraisal which are acceptable to the buyer are not. And whether a particular financing package meets a buyer's needs is necessarily a highly subjective decision dependent on the buyer's overall financial goals, his other investments, his risk tolerance, his personal preferences is what it comes down to. And therefore, the Herder presumption cannot apply in this case. Interestingly, the Court of Appeals and the buyer's reliance on Herder, which used an objective standard to supply the missing price term, contradicts their concession that the financing and appraisal contingency here gave the buyer sole discretion to select the financing terms. Now, if the contract in Herder had specified a price satisfactory to Regnier in Regnier's sole discretion, I don't think there's any question that the Court of Appeals, and this Court if necessary, would have held that contract to be unenforceable.
Well, why can't you read into this contract that it's within the discretion of the buyer about the contract, about the mortgage terms, but that it has to be, the discretion has to be exercised reasonably. Just like the contract says that the general partner, et cetera, have to use reasonable efforts to persuade the limited partners. I mean, that reasonable efforts is an objective standard, but a little slippery.
I don't think...
No, it's not. That was the law about financial, about mortgages, that you had to use reasonable efforts. And if you got a mortgage within the market value of mortgages, then you go.
Well, the answer, Chief Justice, is that that would turn this clause into a satisfaction guaranteed contingency, which it was. And there is a satisfaction guaranteed doctrine that is discussed in the briefs, and that does not collide with Geruth and its progeny. In the words of the Restatement Second, and particularly Comment A to Section 228, the satisfaction or the lack thereof must be with the circumstance and not with the bargain.
I don't understand that language.
Well,
with all due respect to the restatement and you, well, I don't dig it.
Permit me to attempt to explain, okay, Chief Justice.
I'd appreciate that.
Circumstance, as Williston points out, is typically the seller's performance, his services, product, or property. The Ekstrom case, the Keechee case, the exhaust ventilator case all fall in that category. In this case, an example of such a satisfaction guaranteed condition would have been if the buyer is satisfied with the physical condition of the real estate. More broadly, a circumstance is something external to the bargain itself. A promise to buy conditioned on a satisfaction with such a circumstance is a real promise that will be enforced by the courts subject to an implied good faith good faith limitation, if you
like will. A report from the a building inspector.
Yes, that's another example. That would be enforceable because it's a circumstance external to the bargain. In contrast, satisfaction with financing relates to the bargain because financing is simply part of the price. Similarly, satisfaction with an appraisal relates to the bargain because the purpose of the appraisal is to evaluate the price. Thus, a buyer who promises to buy if satisfied with financing and an appraisal effectively promises to buy if he's satisfied with the price, which is no promise at all, or in other words, an illusory promise. Compare the contingency described in the Nodolf case, quoting Corbett. The buyer will purchase land if he procures a loan for that purpose. Now, when Corbin then says that, quote, procuring of a loan is so connected with the buying as to leave the buying also wholly at the buyer's option, he is saying that the financing relates to the bargain itself. That is, he is making the same distinction as the Restatement Second makes. The contingency here says, the buyer shall have obtained financing on terms satisfactory to buyer. That's functionally equivalent to Corbin's example. The requirement of the buyer's satisfaction is expressed here. It's necessarily implicit in the Corbin example. Thus, what you take from these authorities, which this Court, and that's the road this Court has gone down in Geruth, Krause, and Nodolf, is that the function of good faith is to determine whether performance is required or excused once there is a real promise or a promise that can be ascertained. But good faith cannot create a real or ascertainable promise where there is none to begin with. That's what this court said in Guruth in 1962. That's what the Court of Appeals echoed in Perkins. And that's the import of Krause and Nodolf.
Could I ask, was this agreement, in your view, so indefinite from the beginning that, say, in 10 days, if another offer had come along, they could have just taken that and said, get out of here?
Yes. If it was indefinite or illusory from the start. And that's really the advantage of preserving the rules developed starting in Guruth and ending in Nodolf, because the parties can determine at the time of contracting whether they have binding obligations to each other or not, rather than waiting until the time for waiver of the contingency when and holding that the buyer can, by his unilateral act, create a binding contract where none existed before.
Well, now, if your position is that the document itself could have been ignored from day one, is there anything that the purchaser could have done to fix that up through subsequent action?
Sure. The parties could have entered into another contract. They could have modified in writing this contract. Neither of those things happened. But that was the only thing that could have happened to create a binding contract where there was none before. And this is the argument that the buyer makes. It has some superficial allure that when it waived the financing contingency, it cured any flaw in the contract. So why are we bothering ourselves about if it was indefinite or illusory at the beginning? Well, the Krause case, this court in Krause expressly reasoned to the contrary, and Nodolf expressly held to the contrary. Why? Well, in Guruth, Guruth refused to construe the financing contingency to allow the buyer unrestrained discretion to decide if it was satisfied, because that would render the buyer's promise illusory. Nodolf recognized that allowing the buyer to fill in the missing terms of the financing contingency by waiving it amounts to precisely the same thing. It would permit the buyer to redraft the contract by means of a waiver letter, inserting terms that the buyer did not seek and did not disclose to the seller when contracting. Waiver is a unilateral act, and as such, it cannot create a binding obligation where none existed. And this is not only sound doctrinally, it's sound policy. Because prior to the waiver, if you have an indefinite or an illusory contract, there's no question that there's no binding contract. The seller should therefore be able to sell to another buyer if the opportunity arises, or to contract to sell, just as the buyer could abandon the deal with guaranteed impunity. However, if the buyer could transform the contract of validity by his unilateral act of waiver, then the seller, one of two things could happen. The seller could pass up an opportunity to sell to another buyer only to see this buyer later pull out at his unconstrained discretion. Or the seller, believing that the buyer is not going to close, may gamble and sell to another buyer or contract to sell to another buyer and thereby risk conflicting obligations and probably end up in court.
Counsel, Chief, if I may, there's just something very basic that I'm having trouble getting over, and that is, why would commercial parties enter into a document that looks like a contract signed by contract, provisions in the contract, including provisions that both have to do a lot of work about? You know, it's just not they sit there. They have to go get financing. Levins has to, under the terms of the contract, make a recommend to the limited partners that each limited partner participate in the transaction and request that each participating limited partner execute and deliver an instrument of assignment. You know, why do people do this if they know they are entering into an invalid, unenforceable contract? You say this makes good policy. To me, this makes no sense. Why is that?
I do wish to answer your question, but I see my red light is on. May I
answer the question, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. One may speculate as to the motives, but typically a buyer wants as much freedom of action as possible. And if possible, some buyers, I suppose, want an unrestrained freedom of action. They want a guaranteed escape hatch. And I think the bottom line here is if the buyer wants to write that into the contract, wants that in the contract, that's fine, but there is a price to pay. If it doesn't close, the buyer can't then turn around and enforce the contract. This is the best rule, because the parties can close the transaction despite the absence of a binding contract if that remains their mutual intention. Only if one party tries to enforce the contract will the question of enforceability arise. This rule that emanated from Guruth, it encourages the parties to draft a valid contract at the outset, just as Professor Rauschenbusch recommended. And if professional assistance is necessary for that purpose, it's better at the time of contracting than for litigation after the fact. And finally, because the indefinite or illusory financing contingency is for the buyer's benefit and inevitably at the buyer's behest, it is fairer to disconfit the buyer if the seller resists enforcement, that is, if things break down and it doesn't close, than to disconfit the seller during the waiver period by binding him and not binding the buyer. The rule for which Metropolitan contends would convert, and fictionally convert, this bilateral executory contract into the buyer's free option to purchase. That is not what the parties intended. It is a shame that parties put together such an elaborate contract and turns out to be invalid, but this is taking the larger view and not just looking at these parties.
But that turns out to be valid. I mean, you folks are smart folks. You must have known, and whoever drafted this, that it was invalid from the beginning. You know, it's a valid ad initio, right?
Well, I don't know what was in the minds of the parties. One can speculate what was in the minds of the parties. One can imagine all sorts of devious plots, as the buyer has, unlikely as that is. I think the most natural assumption is that the parties intend to complete the transaction, and somewhere along the way, something gets in the way of it, and it breaks down, and the buyer tries to enforce the contract,
What got in the way of it here?
What got in the way of it is that a better offer came along. And it was a condition of this contract that the limited partners, who were not parties to the contract, be willing to participate in this sale at a certain level. When the better offer came along, going back to Justice Rosenstein's question, Ms. Levins, as general partner, had a fiduciary duty to her limited partners to tell them about this development. They soured on the deal. That caused that condition to fail and the contract to terminate. The buyer then sued to enforce the contract, and question one then is the contract valid and enforceable to begin with? The answer here is no.
Does your provision in the contract about the general partner trying to persuade the limited partners does that make this an illusory contract?
No, that does not make an illusory contract. That's a reasonable best effort standard. That means good faith. The cases are so held. They're cited in the brief. And there is a way to measure that. And the trial court found, and the Court of Appeals did not touch the finding, that she did use her reasonable best efforts by informing her limited partners of the development and presenting a fair and balanced information about the two pending deals.
The trial court found that on summary judgment, right?
Yes. Because the facts were undisputed as to what she did and when she did it.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Schmidt, representing Metropolitan Ventures.
May it please the Court, I am Charles Schmidt. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Metropolitan Ventures. I ask that the Court do three things in this case. Number one, that it affirm the Court of Appeals decision insofar as it reversed the Circuit Court's May 22nd order. That will reinstate the claims for breach of implied duty of good faith, interference with contract, and negligence. Second, I ask that the Court reverse that portion of the Circuit Court's judgment based on the April 30th, 2003 order. These claims were raised in the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals didn't touch the issue, but that will reinstate the claims for breach of contract, breach of fiduciary duty, and conversion. And third, the Court should remand the case back to the Circuit Court for further proceedings. Now, before I begin addressing the substantive issues, I just want to touch upon two questions that were asked. Justice Bradley asked how that contract should be construed. I point out that 7.3 expressly says that the rules of construction regarding the drafting party are not in play in construing this contract. And Justice Rogensack asked whether Ms. Levins had a fiduciary duty to convey the May 8th offer to her limited partners. Regardless of whether that duty exists, she never did. She denied the deal outright, and 2 days later she made an offer of her own. So don't be confused between the May 8th offer from Steadfast, which we contend was not unsolicited. That's not an undisputed fact. And that information never made it to the limited partners. To my knowledge, they still don't know about that offer.
Okay, so what I have in the record here as the offer from Steadfast is not Steadfast's offer?
Steadfast made an offer, but Ms. Levins rejected it. She said, no, the offer doesn't look good. There's too many contingencies. 2 days later on May 10th, which is in Metropolitan's brief, she submitted an offer of her own.
And what was the difference between the two offers?
I don't recall off the top of my head, but I just want to clarify. I'm supposing that there were less contingencies. But it's not some unsolicited offer that came in the door. She never mentioned that offer to her partners, regardless of whether it's unsolicited, which we contend it wasn't. She made an offer of her own. She went out and found a buyer.
Okay, I have another question along a similar line. When I look at the assignment that the limited partners were to provide, it said it's not effective until closing. And once they sign it, they don't become parties to the limited partner purchase agreement either. So did they have a right to rescind their signed assignments?
Well, that goes to the escrow argument, and no, they didn't have a right.
Why not?
The law in Wisconsin has been clear in the Schmidt case that I pointed out in the brief, and there was a Western Federal case, I believe, that points out that irrevocability is a presumption in the law unless there's something in the contract that suggests otherwise. In this case, the LPPA and the assignments never suggested that they were revocable.
But it says they're not effective. Those are the words that are in the assignment. They are not effective until closing, and the general partner was supposed to deliver so many units at closing. And so I was a little surprised that, in fact, when they signed the assignment, they didn't become parties by their signature to the limited partnership agreement. But there's nothing in the assignment that binds the limited partners.
They weren't bound to sell under the agreement.
Right, and that's right. Right.
That point is undisputed, but they were bound to follow the procedure that was set forth in the LPPA, which was to send the assignments to Ms. Levins, who was supposed to hold them to closing. This is no different than if I'm buying your house and I put a check into escrow. It's not effective until you sign the check at closing. But it doesn't mean that an escrow can't be formed.
Yeah, well, I didn't see anything about an escrow in the agreement, so that is of some...
Well, an escrow is similar to a contract. You don't necessarily have to put the term escrow in writing and call it an escrow agreement any more than you have to write contract at the top of a contract.
Well, you know, in California, they close an escrow all the time. You close on real estate and you get the money transferred 2 weeks later, but everything is done in escrow with the title company, and that's all in the agreement.
No, in this case, they chose to use Ms. Levins for whatever reason.
Okay, so but you, in answer to my initial question, you don't dispute that the limited partners, by signing the assignment, were obligated to complete that assignment at closing.
Once they sent it to Ms. Levins, it was held in escrow. Ms. Levins was obligated to turn those over at closing. She had no right to send them back.
Well, but if they rescinded by a prior writing, did they have a right to do that?
Well, that brings in extrinsic evidence, and my contention is no. They can't simply say, well, I want the money back any more than if I were to sell you my house. I can say, I want the check back, and...
Yeah, but you and I are parties to the contract if I'm selling you my house or you're selling me yours. My concern is the limited partners were never parties to the contract.
They were. Ms. Levins signed on behalf of them. They weren't obligated to sell under the contract, but they were obligated to follow the procedure. If they decided to sell, then the procedure said that things were supposed to be held in escrow, which was the assignment.
All right. Now, thank you.
Can we just ask you this? The Court of Appeals, as I understand it, reversed the granting of summary judgment in favor of GEA, and there were two orders in effect.
Correct.
One dismissed the complaint, and the other one appears to have
granted judgment for the defendant. And in the Court of Appeals decision, they reversed. Are they reversing both orders?
The Court of Appeals, unfortunately, only touched the second order, which was the no-contract theory. The prior order dismissed half of the claims and allowed the other half to go forward.
Right. Okay. So where are we? That's what's bothering me in this case. What got appealed to the Court of Appeals? What did the Court of Appeals decide? And then what's really before this court?
Everything.
Do you understand my question?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Everything was appealed to the Court of Appeals. All the issues raised in both my brief and then Mr. Barr's reply brief, he raised three additional issues. Those were all before the Court of Appeals.
Right.
The Court decided only the no contract issue, which means that we had no ruling on the other issues. Mr. Barr petitioned this Court for review. As the petitioner, he had the obligation to bring up whatever issues he didn't like. He only brought up the one regarding the no contract. As the party who won in the Court of Appeals, I had no adverse judgment. I raised the remaining issues that I wanted decided in my brief. If this Court doesn't decide the issues, I guess in the sense of, in the interest of judicial economy, what we do is we go back down to the Circuit Court and we've got a guaranteed second appeal.
You go down to the Circuit Court on what? You go down to the Circuit Court on the total complaint?
No, if you affirm this Court of Appeals with nothing more, then we go back down and the remaining issues will be...
Go back down to the Circuit Court.
The Circuit Court,
to
correct.
To decide...
Breach of good faith duty, intentional interference with contract, and negligence. Those will be the three claims for trial.
Breach of good faith, duty, negligence?
Breach of duty of good faith, negligence, and intentional interference with contract.
Okay.
You already have a ruling on those three, don't you? From the
Supreme Court? The first ruling allowed us to move forward on those claims. The second one dismissed it on the no contract theory. So, yes, I do have a ruling from the Court of Appeals that says now you can go forward with these claims. So if this court affirms the Court of Appeals, we'll go back down to the Circuit Court, presumably on remand, to have a trial on those three claims.
And they raise issues of fact, or could raise issues of material fact.
Each of them does, yes.
Good faith, negligence generally does, and intentional interference.
Correct.
Might, because you've got a mental element there, which is subject to proof. One person's going to say yes, the other's going to say no, I assume.
That's right.
And this is a summary judgment, so you're sending it. Your position, then, I gather, is to send it all back to the circuit.
My position is the court can simply affirm the Court of Appeals and grant summary judgment in our favor based on the facts. But for the benefit of the doubt, I'll concede that there will be some disputed issues on the way back down.
Okay. On these three issues, too. Okay.
Now,
what do you expect this decision of this court to read if you were going to write it?
I would say by the court, the decision of the...
What reasons?
Well, I think that the easiest way to address the no-contract theory is to simply look at the case law across the country regarding satisfaction clauses. If you type in on Westlaw, satisfaction clause with an exclamation point at the end of clause in quotes, my last research effort revealed 132 of these cases across the country. Every single...
Dealing with financing satisfaction.
Well, I sent a supplemental authority letter to the court yesterday, and it cites quite a few of them. If you look at the restatement provision, it cites about 50 more, and I would estimate about 10 of them or so deal specifically with financing.
Mm-hmm. Does the clause read to the satisfaction of the buyer?
Correct. It's a standard contingency. In fact, Mr. Barr's own expert agreed that it was a usual contingency. These clauses are universally upheld. Sometimes there's issues of fact where, there's a tangential issue that a court may reverse, but no jurisdiction in the United States has ever held that these are illusory or indefinite. And they've been upheld since the 1880s, I suppose. This court's looked at them. Every other court cited in the restatements looked at them. This court would be the first one in the United States to break from that and say that you can't leave something to the good faith, reasonable exercise of discretion.
Well, how do you explain the cases upon which GEA relies?
The Garouf line of cases is different in that none of those cases, including the unpublished decisions that they cite in their brief, left discretion to The buyer. None of them say it's to the satisfaction of the buyer. They just say satisfactory financing. If you say satisfactory financing, that brings the issue up, whose satisfaction? The buyer, the seller? What are the terms of that financing? There was no meeting of the minds. Here we clearly had a meeting of the minds. It's undisputed that this contingency was intended for the sole benefit of Metropolitan. Metropolitan had to use its good faith, best efforts to go out and find financing, and it did find financing. In fact, it waived the financing contingency, and it dropped out of the contract. So, if you look at these satisfaction clause cases, this is a very common thing to see in contracts, inspection financing clauses. In fact, the courts have upheld these types of clauses even in cases where it's something as subjective as artwork.
So you think Duluth is distinguishable?
I believe it's clearly distinguishable, again, because the satisfaction clause wasn't in any of those cases.
And what about Herder?
Well, Herder, I think, is a default. If this court wants to say that we no longer recognize satisfaction clauses in this state and break from the four or five decisions that expressly have, you can always look to Herder and say, first of all, under Guruth, the only thing that Guruth requires is the amount of financing which this contract had. Second, you can say under Herder there was subsequent conduct by both parties which effectively rewrote the provision. Initially, the consideration was $7,500 in earnest money, and we released the petitioners from the property purchase agreement under which they were bound to sell the property anyway for the exact same price, $3.3 million. We went out, we found financing, and then we tendered the sale price three separate times. If you look at the record, it was April 25th, May 1st, and May 14th, all three times before the petitioners decided the contract was terminated. For their part, the petitioners contend that they went out and they sent out their letter to the limited partners recommending the deal close, and they provided documents to us. There clearly was consideration on both sides. So if the court wants to accept the reasoning in Guruth and get rid of these satisfaction clauses, it can still say that under Herder, there was a meeting of the minds that as of April 25th, at least, this contingency just dropped out of the contract, and effectively they had a new contract. Now, Mr. Barr will stand up and he'll say that you can't have one party unilaterally drop something out of a contract and have a new contract. But as a matter of common sense, when the contract itself says that any party who has a contingency for its exclusive benefit can waive that contingency, i.e. that the petitioners don't care what the financing is, it makes no sense to make them rewrite a second contract. Dealing with that, we also have the equitable considerations.
Counsel, just before you get to the equitable considerations, I hear your response then as affirming the Court of Appeals, but really on a little different analysis. As I recall reading their opinion, they were embracing the Herder-Hallmark case, and that was the essence of their analysis. Am I correct or incorrect?
You are correct. I think it would be a lot cleaner for the court to just say that this is a satisfaction clause, but the Court of Appeals' reasoning was sound as well, because it not only looked at Herder, but it also considered Guruth and said the amount of financing was put forward in the contract, implicitly assuming that that was all they needed. And it also, again, looked at the equities. This was a contract that was drafted by both parties. I don't know if the record's clear as to who settle the final wording on the financing contingency, but both parties did exchange some back and forth on that. But Mr. Barr's sole partner helped draft this contract, and now he's standing here saying that this contract was invalid. He's essentially accusing his partner of negligence or some sort of intentional malfeasance. Lucky for his partner, the law doesn't say that he should contact his malpractice insurer. This is a perfectly valid satisfaction clause. Courts have recognized them for well over 100 years. Now, as for the breach of contract issue, I guess I want to touch on that.
Mr. Schmidt,
question,
so that the proposition that the other party could have pulled out right away to accept a better offer, your answer to that is no, that's not.
Absolutely not. It was a valid contract from day one. Metropolitan had a duty to go out and use good faith and find financing. It did find financing. And really the only issue as to whether this gave them unlimited discretion would come up if they had not found financing and said that they were dissatisfied with what was out there. And Mr. Barr has asserted that this financing was something entirely within their control, but that's not true. Metropolitan had no control over what the banks were going to offer. He had to go from bank to bank, and they had to go from bank to bank and find a bank that gave suitable loan rates for a suitable duration. If he had said he was dissatisfied with all of them, then the tables would be turned and the petitioners could come in here and challenge the...
But let me ask this. Suppose the buyer had signed the March 19th agreement and then done nothing at all, in effect tying up the seller for a month. Is there any remedy for the seller for that conduct?
Sure, a breach of contract claim. That would be a flagrant breach of the contract. They had a duty to use good faith to go out and find financing. If they had done nothing, that's not good faith. And again, those financing contingency cases cited in the letter yesterday clearly point out that's the case. In fact, one specifically addresses that point.
Counselor, I want to look back at the fact that your offer was contingent on financing. If Levine had received this offer, and it does have contingencies, but are you complaining that she didn't bring this offer to you for an opportunity to meet it or to release your contingencies, or do you think she just didn't have any right to consider this offer after she had signed on for the partnership with Metropolitan?
Well, as an initial matter, she shouldn't have solicited the offer. Furthermore, I don't think the May 8th offer is really in play because that offer was never accepted. It was never conveyed to the limited partners. It's the May 10th offer that she made on her own.
Let me tell you what's bothering me. You know, in my past life, I was a lawyer and did a fair number of real estate closings. And if there was an offer that was contingent on financing for the purchase of someone's house and the property stayed on the market, which is usually the case unless you bargain for something more, and another offer came in that was a clean offer with no financing. It's the practice I'm familiar with that the seller tells the buyer, hey, I got a clean offer for X dollars. Doesn't matter if the price is higher or the same, just a clean offer. You know, you either have to remove your contingency or I'm taking that other offer. So my concern, my question to you is really with that in the back of my mind, did Levine have an obligation to bring this offer to Metropolitan for their consideration about whether they wanted to meet the offer or not before she sent it on?
That goes directly to the breach of contract. If you look at the contract, it says she has to use her reasonable best efforts to ensure that none of the property is sold before the closing. So I don't see how keeping the property on the market, making offers back and forth, telling the other party that there's a window of opportunity, how can that be best efforts under any reading of that clause. So I agree with you. Mr. Barr likes to call this an exclusivity provision, and he contends that there wasn't one in this case. But that begs the question, what does it mean to use your best efforts not to dispose the property prior to closing?
Well, you can look at it two different ways. I mean, his position is that there was no exclusivity. Property often stays on the market. Your clients had backed out once before on the sale for the same building, though they were buying the real estate rather than the limited partnership interest. So, okay, well, thank you. You answered my question.
Well, to address the back out, I'd like to just point out that that's not an undisputed fact in the case. Insofar as the Metropolitan backed out of the first deal, it was sort of a mutual agreement that they were going to proceed with a business sale. Both sides reaped some benefit from that as opposed to the property sale. And in backing out, the only document that confirms the back out is the LPPA itself. If they had never signed that, Mr. Barr's clients would still be bound by the property purchase agreement. So really, he has his cake and he can eat it, too. He gets out of the property purchase agreement by signing the LPPA, which he contends is invalid, and then he goes on and steps out of the business sale as well. As for the breach of contract claims, I think it's also important to consider the best effort duties to go out and solicit the assignments from the limited partners. There's clearly an issue of fact there. There's overwhelming evidence that Ms. Levins didn't comply with that duty as well. So we've got two separate breaches of contract here. Not only did she breached the best efforts duty to prevent a sale of the property prior to closing, but she also breached her duty to go out and actually get the assignments. They gloss over the fact that she sent out an initial letter, and 74% of the limited partners said, yes, let's sell. That was far more than the two-thirds contingency that they had in the contract.
Was that before she subsequently, was that before she notified the limited partners of the new offer?
I don't know. I think that it was certainly before the offer was terminated by the petitioners, but I don't know when the assignments came in. But I don't know if it really makes a difference. She had the assignments. They kept coming in before or after she notified them of the second offer. They kept coming in. So she had enough to close. She just refused to close the deal. Metropolitan kept sending her letters and saying, we're ready, willing, and able, three separate times. Let's close this deal. And she said no. Clearly, at that point, she had a motivation not to close because she managed to solicit a better offer. And, in fact, she actually made a better offer and tied herself up with two separate contracts. Now, going to that, it's important to note that the Steadfast contract, the second contract, was actually, by its very terms, not effective unless the initial offer terminated. The only way to terminate the initial offer that she saw was to send notice of this offer that didn't yet exist to her limited partners, and she sent them a side-by-side comparison and said, look, here's two viable options. Choose which one you'd like to take. This isn't, at a minimum, there's a reasonable inference here that this was not done in good faith and that this was in a violation of her duty to obtain the assignments. She had the assignments and gave them back and said, why don't you make up your minds again, and here's a roadmap as to how I think you can get out of the deal. Now, the third issue that I'd like to address briefly is the fiduciary duties and the conversion claim. That's based on the escrow theory that we've put forth in the brief. The limited partner, the LPPA was set up so that Ms. Levin signed on behalf of the limited partners as well as on behalf of herself. Mr. Gensel signed on behalf of Metropolitan Ventures. So all the parties were bound. And again, no party was bound to sell at that point. They were bound to follow the procedure in the LPPA. In effect, the LPPA was really for Ms. Levin's services more than anything else. She did have a duty at closing to turn over her partnership sales, but it was effectively a service contract. She had to go out and solicit these offers from other people. So again, that goes to Mr. Barr's economic loss doctrine argument under Cease Electric. This is a service contract primarily, while it did have some transfer of a real property. It just is immaterial in this case because it was clearly secondary.
Would you say that any real estate offer to purchase is a service contract for the broker who is obligated to try to keep the deal together?
Well, again, I don't think that this is actually, insofar as it involves the broker, yes, it is a service contract.
And what was Ms. Levine paid for her services?
She had it coming in both ways. She was acting as a broker. She never told anybody that she was a broker, so she got half commission. The limited partners were unaware. Metropolitan was unaware.
I think that was at least it's in the materials that were submitted with the appendix. When she sent the letter out, she disclosed to the limited partners she was a broker on both this deal and the other deal, and she also disclosed what the percentage was and what she would receive. So unless I shouldn't have that and I got it out of the appendix, I think it's in the record.
No, I don't disagree that she did inform them after the second deal came in, and she said, oh, by the way, I'm getting a commission on this. But she didn't tell anybody beforehand. So she was getting a kickback on the commission from MLG, and then on top of it, she was also getting money as a limited partner or as a general partner when the deal ultimately closed.
But that was to give up her shares, like you would
right.
get money if you gave up your house, right?
Yes, but her primary duties under the contract were to go out and obtain the offers. The contract doesn't address her duties as a broker. Those duties were in a secret agreement between her and Mooney LaSage Group.
And the duties as a broker were paid for by the sellers, not by the buyers, correct?
Again, I'm not clear on that, but I believe that's correct.
Thank you.
Could I ask the financing contingency, is the rule or should the rule be different in a real estate case than in a business case?
Well, I think the initial question is, was this a valid satisfaction clause? But if the, again, if the court gets to that secondary argument, then, yes, I do agree that there should be some difference, at least in business contracts that don't involve this fixed sale price. If you have a variable sale price, it begs the question, how do you get financing? You can't walk into the bank and say, I'm going to be buying something for somewhere between $2 million and $3 million. What kind of interest rate can I get? So any loan commitment is going to be based on just speculation about the ultimate sale price, and ultimately the loan commitment is going to be different than the ultimate loan terms, because at closing, then you know what the actual deal is, and precisely what happened to Metropolitan in this case. They had a commitment, but they didn't have the final terms yet. So they did what they could do. They got financing, but those terms of financing were possibly subject to change upon completion of the deal. It doesn't make any sense for the court to say that parties should have to speculate about terms of financing and then judicially amend the Wisconsin statutes to say a financing clause has to have amortization period and loan duration and cost of financing and all these other things. The common law has always been that you can simply say, as long as it's clear in the contract, this is for the exercise of good faith satisfaction of the buyer. Now, one other backup that the Court of Appeals also looked at, the Court of Appeals decision was kind of an amalgamation of a number of different arguments. It not only said that this, at least implicitly, that this clause complied with Guth and that it had the amount of financing. It looked at the equitable features. I think that was the last element that it looked at. But it also looked at the fact that the contingency was waived. A financing contingency is a condition precedent, which basically just means that it's a condition to one party's duty to perform under the contract. The second that was waived, it was eliminated from the contract as if it didn't exist. The law is very clear that parties that have a financing contingency for their benefit can waive the financing contingency and move forward. There are a number of cases, in fact, like all conditions precedent addressed in Godfrey, it no longer provides an escape hatch for anybody. I think that the court can't ignore the fact that under Mr. Barr's theory, there was this built-in escape hatch, and it wasn't just Metropolitan's ability to squirm out from under the contract. It was the petitioner's ability to squirm out from under the contract. They're saying we had a deal, we could go forward with the deal if we wanted to go forward with the deal. If something better came along, we could go with that. I think that it's a much cleaner judicial philosophy to say that parties are bound by what they sign. If you sign a contract that says that one party has a satisfaction clause, you're not getting some sort of hidden deal here. You agreed to it. If you wanted something for your protection on the financing, then you should also have a contingency for your benefit that says that you have to approve of the financing.
Counselor, if I buy your argument that Ms. Levine had an obligation, a personal obligation under the contract, to use best efforts to get the limited partners to sell, and I also buy what I understood you to say before, and that the limited partners, were not obligated to keep their assignments in play, you really can't get to the point of being able to actually purchase the limited partnership, correct? You can only get damages for her if the trial court were to find that for her not performing under the contract. But you still can't get to a purchase, can you?
Well, I disagree, I guess, with one of the underlying premises.
All right, straighten me out. That would be a big help.
The limited partners weren't obligated to sell, but once they sent the assignments to Levins, they were obligated to sell. These assignments were to be held in escrow. There were seven.
Can you tell me where it says that, please? Where does it say in the agreement the assignments were to be held in escrow? I'm sorry, I must have missed that.
I believe it's section 1.1.
Okay, thank you. As long as it's in there, 1.1.
It just explains, it doesn't use the word escrow, but that makes no difference any more than the LPPA doesn't say this is a contract, it says agreement. It sets up the procedure to pass these along. Ms. Levins had 74% of the limited partnership assignments. She should have set a closing date, and she refused to set a closing date. At the point that Metropolitan tendered its money on April 25th, May 1st, and May 14th, She had an obligation to hand over the assignments. Metropolitan had an obligation to pay for those assignments, and the deal should have been done. So, again, there was no revocability. Irrevocability is the presumption in Wisconsin law.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Barr, you have 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. In the short time I have, I will resist the temptation to enmesh myself in the issues that the Court of Appeals didn't decide and discuss briefly the issues that it did decide and the policy issues, the broad policy issues really before this Court.
Counselor, I'm going to have to redirect you because I want you to respond to opposing counsel's argument that these assignments, once they were mailed to your client, either before or after another offer was in play, were non-revocable.
Certainly, Justice Rogenczak, and I was going to add that I'll certainly respond to any questions the Court has.
They're captive out there.
We believe, and we respectfully submit, the trial court looked at the contracts, looked at the individual provisions, synthesized them properly, and explained in great detail, and that's in the appendix in its oral ruling, why there was no why your initial question was right, or the premise of your initial question was right. The limited partners had no obligation to sell, and their assignments were revocable. They could change their minds before at any time before closing. They simply weren't parties to this contract any more than the shareholders of a corporation are parties to the contracts that a corporation signs. Many of these limited partners sent instruments to Ms. Levins with explicit instructions restricting her authority to deliver them. Don't deliver them if a better offer comes along. As the trial court pointed out, the use of the term consenting limited partnerships consenting limited partners in section 5.6 of the contract implies that the limited partners may grant, withhold, or withdraw their consent. Pursuant to section 1.1 of the contract, the transaction could not close unless Levins could, one, obtain the assignments, and two, deliver them at closing, which implies that the limited partners could change their minds between Levins' receipt of their assignments and the date of closing. And again, the limited partners had no duty to begin with to sell their interests to the buyer. They never received any consideration for it, so it's obvious that they could revoke their assignments before the closing. Have I adequately answered your question?
Yeah, right, you did. Thank you very much.
I want, in just a few minutes, to talk about the broad policy issues before this Court. We haven't talked much, although there was a question from Justice Prosser, I believe, and also from Justice Crooks about the business sale rationale of the Court of Appeals. The buyer really isn't relying on that now, and I submit it's indefensible. There's no principled way to distinguish between a business sale and a real estate sale when what is being transferred is the real estate that the business owns. And in fact, this Court could on a narrow basis hold that the contract here was, in essence, in reality, in substance, a contract for the sale of real estate under the Kurth case. That's exactly the analysis this Court used in the Kurth case. Therefore, the Guruth rules apply. There is no principal distinction between the two. And to illustrate this point, look at the financing contingencies in the forms that real estate and business brokers are mandated to use in this state by the Department of Regulation and Licensing. They're all substantively the same. They're virtually the same, almost exactly the same wording, showing that these rules, which have developed in Guruth through Nodolf and which has affected the practice in Wisconsin, and culminating in these detailed financing provisions, that's the result of 43 years of doctrine that's emanated from this Court and the Court of Appeals. And make no mistake, the buyer is asking you to throw out those cases. The buyer cannot win. The buyer cannot prevail here unless you overrule Guruth and its progeny, unless you disavow Nodolf, unless you disavow the language in Krause that said, when there's an indefinite or illusory financing contingency, and even though it's for the benefit of the buyer and the buyer wants to waive it, the seller can nonetheless avoid the deal because a better offer comes along. Why? Because there was never a binding contract. Why is that the better rule, despite the inconvenience to which it might have put these particular parties? For the reasons that I've explained, we don't want a situation where, pending the waiver, the buyer is free as a bird and the seller is, in effect, bound. We don't want a situation where we have a free option to purchase in the buyer's favor. He never gave any consideration for it. It's not what the parties ever intended, but that's the effect of it unless you retain the rules of Guruth, Krause, and Nodolf. I see my...
What's the matter with a contract that would say, here are the terms, but I have 30 days to change my mind? And you don't, and you and I agree.
If the changing the mind is at the unconstrained discretion, just says change my mind, that's illusory. You haven't promised anything. There's no mutuality of obligation there. And it all comes down to the bedrock principle of contract law, and the rules of Guruth through Nodolf are contract law rules, not real estate law rules. It all comes down to the bedrock rule that a promise must be supported by consideration, and in a bilateral executory contract, that consideration is another promise. And if you say, I have 30 days to change my mind for whatever reason I deem necessary, you haven't promised anything at all. It's an illusory promise. So was the financing contingency, because it in effect said, I will buy if I like the price. If it ends up that I like the price, I will buy. That is not a promise. That's an illusory promise. It's a narrow window, but there is such a thing as an illusory promise. It's easy to draft to get around it if you really want to. And if you hold for Metropolitan, you will wipe out the illusory promise doctrine, even though your cases, Guruth, Krause, and the Court of Appeals in Nodolf, Williston, Corbin, Restatement, they all recognize this doctrine.
What about a unilateral contract? I'm going to sell this land to you on the following, sell this business to you on the following conditions, blah, 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 to which you've agreed, if you tell me in 30 days you're going to buy it.
If you tell me in 30 days you're going to buy it.
Final contract. This prize is open to you. Yeah. This prize is open to you if you perform in 30 days. If you don't perform, it's not there.
The parties can draft and craft for themselves an option agreement if that is what they really intend. Now, the buyer's option must be supported by consideration. If this were construed as an option contract, it would fail because there was no consideration. The buyer promised, in effect, nothing.
I promised to tell you in 30 days. That's something.
Okay, that knows it. Okay.
And that's what happened here. You promised to waive this in 30 days.
No.
You want to go ahead with the contract.
That's not true, Chief Justice. It could have said the buyer at least promises to tell us, the sellers, within by the waiver deadline, if they're waiving the deadline or not. They didn't even promise to do that. The contract automatically terminated. They could literally sit on their hands and do nothing during the waiver period, and this contract would automatically terminate. So you have made a good point. You can narrow the illusory promise doctrine even further, restrict the universe of illusory promises by saying if the buyer at least promises to make the affirmative act of telling the seller that we are waiving, then you have at least some minimal consideration, and it's arguably adequate. In this case, there was not even that. They didn't promise to apply for financing. They didn't promise to get an appraisal. If they did, it was totally up to their unfettered discretion whether it was satisfactory, and they did not even promise to tell the sellers if it was satisfied. So if there is such a thing as an illusory promise, and all these authorities, including your own cases, say that there is, this is it.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Barr. Thank you, Mr. Schmidt, for your argument on
this offer to purchase arrangement, and we will now conclude the hearing in 03-AP-1806, Metropolitan Ventures versus GEA Associates. We'll take a short recess so these students may leave if they wish, and other students may enter the courtroom. We're in recess for a few moments.